judges that have served the system. Jim, you served from when, 1968 until 1981?
One moment, let me back up just a little bit. I just needed to get a sound test on you. Are you ladies going to go out?
I'm going to step out and good luck. And the phone is right out here. And you have my number already. And I'll be back.
Okay. So, ready?
All right, I was in the district court from 1963 to 68.
That's correct.
And then I left, went into private practice for a couple of years, and then was appointed in December of 1970, and hung around either full or part-time until the early 90s.
Let's start with some of your personal background, Jim. Where were you born?
Born in Northwood, North Dakota.
And the other members of your family, your mom, dad?
Mother and dad were both born in Northwood, North Dakota. Two of my sisters were born there, one in Fargo, North Dakota. I went to public schools, grades 3 through 12 in Fargo, North Dakota. Then to a couple of colleges where I didn't do all that well, and then into the Navy. Then I came back and went to the University of North Dakota, where I got 2 degrees.
And how about your sisters? What direction did they head off to?
One of them is a nurse, has been an OR nurse, for operating room nurse for many, many years, retired now. One of them is a teacher who is now retired. The oldest of my sisters graduated from college, but became a housewife then, and her husband just retired from teaching in North Dakota after having retired from teaching in Minnesota 20 years ago.
It's marvelous. My family, most of them were teachers also.
Very proud of the brother-in-law who taught in both states, because he's in the North Dakota and Minnesota Coaches Hall of Fame, and is in a National Coaches Hall of Fame as a wrestling coach. So.
Wow. And starting in North Dakota, what communities did you then move through?
We simply went from the Northwood area after 7 years of not having any crops, because it didn't rain for 7 years. We moved to Fargo, and my parents stayed there until they died.
And were there any really significant events you remember in your childhood?
I clearly remember Pearl Harbor. And I think I remember every significant thing that's happened since then.
Yes.
I remember VJ Day. Tornado hit Fargo and destroyed about a fifth of the community right after I got out of the Navy in 1956. And they put us back on active duty for a while.
Did you attend high school in Fargo?
I did.
So Fargo was about the big city in North Dakota that
yeah.
You remember most
after
of it.
After fighting the Korean War in South Carolina and Florida, I came back and went to the University of North Dakota at Grand Forks.
What really inspired you to pursue a career in law, Jim?
I really wasn't planning to be a lawyer even when I went to law school. I graduated with a business degree, and I went and talked to the dean about what I should do toward getting a master's. He said, forget the master's, they're not worth the paper they're printed on right now. What you should do is go up to law school and just take all the business courses up there. He said, even if you don't want to be a lawyer, you'll be a lot more welcome in the business world with that law background.
And what about that law school experience? Did you enjoy it?
I did enjoy it. I enjoyed it quite a lot. And when we did mock trials, I suddenly became very excited about becoming a lawyer. And after that, decided that I wanted to be a trial lawyer.
And is that because of the challenges you found when you got to law school?
Well, yes. My grades were good in law school, but I didn't really enjoy it that much until we got into these mock trials, and I got a taste of what that could be like. We actually had state district judges, equivalent to the Superior Court here preside over those trials, and we have mock juries, and it was fun.
How did you come to get up here to Alaska?
I had been everywhere in the country except Alaska, and I'd read all about it in the Field and Stream and Sports Field type magazines. So during spring break of our senior year, I came up here, and I traveled to Anchorage, Fairbanks, and Juneau, interviewed a lot of firms. I received an offer in Anchorage, I received an offer in Fairbanks, but when I got to Juneau, I received the best offer of all in the firm of Fokker Banfield, Hoochever and Dugan, which was then the biggest firm in the state.
What were your family circumstances at the time?
I had two daughters.
My
wife, unfortunately we were divorced, but my wife, a 2-year-old daughter and a 3-month-old daughter, came up over the Elkhorn in a camper van. That by itself would take a half hour to tell you about. Needless to say, it had been raining for days and the highway wasn't paved. That sums it up. Got into Juneau. When I had been there in the spring, I was there for 3 days and never saw a cloud. After we moved there, I was there for 11 months without ever seeing any blue sky. And my wife at that point said, "You can stay here if you want to, but I'm leaving." Norman Banfield, one of the partners in the firm, suggested we try Anchorage. And he knew there was a district magistrate opening here and offered to and did fly up here and spent a couple of days with Ed Davis, who was then the presiding judge who appointed magistrates. So within 3 months, I was a magistrate in Anchorage.
Describe, if you will, I'm sure it will be of interest in the future. What was the legal community like in Juneau when you got there? I'm sure it was, even because of my memories, it was a lot different from Anchorage, a lot smaller, a lot more knit. But what was it like? Were some of the great pioneers in Juneau, or did you find
them? They were, and they got along. It was amazing. The two firms in Anchorage were Robertson Montague, Lee Stone Ennis, and the Banfield Hoochever. The lawyers got along very well. Roger Connor, later a justice in the Supreme Court, was in sole practice there and was one of the most interesting people I ever met. Brilliant, strange. Roger actually, during the interview, offered me a job with him. Several other people said that would not be a good idea. Banfield Hoochever took me to lunch and hired me. It was a real learning experience. I learned more from Norman Banfield and Bob Hoochever in the year and a half I spent there than I did in 3 years of law school.
Well, who were the judges you appeared before down there?
I didn't appear before any judge down there, but the only judge I could have appeared for was Judge Vonderheit. He was the sole Superior Court judge in Juneau. Judge Walsh was the Superior Court judge in Ketchikan. And he came up from Ketchikan to try, I think, the only criminal trial that was conducted in Juneau in 1963. Judge Vonderheit, I think, had DQ'd himself. Judge Walsh came up and tried that case. I don't think there were any other felony trials. Jack Asher was the district attorney in Juneau in 1962-63. Jack wasn't inclined to work very hard if it wasn't necessary. So usually you could plead anything out, and that's what happened.
And this was obviously right after statehood, and the court system was really just being formed, and it didn't have all that much form from at least what I read. They were still struggling to find their identity and setting up offices around the state. And
well, there's no question that Jim Vonderheide knew what the court was all about. He was a kind, gentle man, but there was no nonsense in his court. I recall being in the law library one day when an attorney attempted to discuss a pending case with him in the law library, and Judge Vonderheide didn't raise his voice, but he made it very, very clear in very few words that was inappropriate.
And then you say that you came to Anchorage and became a magistrate?
Correct. The district judges now are where what the magistrates were then, although the jurisdiction has increased substantially. And I like to think I had a significant part in getting the district court placed under the Missouri plan, so the judges are merit appointments now, and not because your boss knows the presiding judge very well in Anchorage. I'm glad I got that appointment. I hope I did a good job. I certainly didn't want to embarrass Mr. Banfield, so I worked very hard at it. I became the presiding judge within 4 months. And in those days, the Superior Court and the District Court operated separately, very much so, except that we were all subject to firing by the presiding district judge. We had our own clerk of court, our own staff. You never saw a Superior Court judge on the first floor of 941 4th Avenue, now gone.
Yes.
And it was interesting. It might be interesting to know that the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, Buell Nesbitt, in those days, reviewed every budget request. It had, I think, must have gone through several red pencils in the budgeting process. And I recall that for three years running, the district court asked for some sort of recording equipment, a dictaphone or something like that, and each year he slashed it. And the other judges were feeling very insulted because they couldn't have a... So I went to see the Chief Justice, talked to him and asked him about it, if they couldn't get us at least. And he looked at me, and you've met Buell, I'm sure. He looked at me and said, "Jim, you're a trial court judge. Trial court judges make decisions. They do not write opinions. You don't need a dictating. You don't need..." That was the end of that.
Was Tom Stewart the administrative director?
Tom was the administrator. The court administration at that time consisted of Tom Stewart, the administrative director, John Peterson, his assistant who did everything else, Marge Laurie, who handled finances statewide, and Ernest Raybach, who was the court's attorney. Raybach, Laurie, and Peterson had a secretary, one secretary. The Chief Justice had another secretary, Irene. She's now Irene Robinson. Her husband practices in Sylvania. But that was the entire court administration.
Things have changed.
Oh, yeah. And they probably only went through about 20 pounds of paper in a year.
What were the kinds of cases you were handling when you came here to Anchorage?
Well, I was handling a variety of cases. There wasn't a lot to do when I first got here because the calendaring procedure under my predecessor assigned you one case a day with no backup cases. If that case fell through, which 90% of them did, you literally had nothing to do for the rest of the day. So when I became presiding, I set three a days for everybody, much to the dismay of my fellows, and we became busy.
What was the bar like in Anchorage at that time?
They were wonderful. They would fight like cats and dogs in the courtroom. Then they would leave the courtroom and go down to what was in the common meeting place for lawyers, the Hofbräu, is a restaurant bar that went down with the earthquake. But far more cases resolved at the more cases were resolved in the Hofbräu than in the courthouse.
And you were in Anchorage during the earthquake?
I was.
Explain that day to me.
Pardon?
Explain that day to me. Tell me what happened.
Well, I was on my way home. I lived down in Sand Lake, and I was in a store in Spinard called the Piggly Wiggly Grocery Store. The Play It Again Sports is now there. And the shaking began, and cans and jars were flying off the shelves, and people were screaming. Somehow managed to get out of the door. There were three very large ladies standing right in the doorway screaming their heads off. And another person about my age came up and he said, "You push and I'll pull." So he snuck out the door, and one by one we moved the ladies out of the way. And the people just streamed out of that store. I got in my car driving down Spinard Road with the road still undulating. It was weird. It looked like a long rug being shaken. And I got about two blocks from my house, and I noticed that all the icicles were still hanging on the eaves of one of the homes there. Obviously that made me feel pretty good, because there hadn't been a whole lot of shaking going on. And when I got home, there was absolutely no damage to my home. My wife, who was I think 7 months pregnant at the time, was very frightened. We didn't have any power, because obviously the power was down everywhere. Then I finally went out and listened to the radio in the car, and I don't remember which of the stations had come back on, but it was either Jeannie Chance or Theta Comstock, who was telling the world that there were reports of hundreds of dead people killed in downtown Anchorage. We were ex officio coroners in those days, so I was responsible for dead people. And I headed downtown, and I got to 9th Avenue and C Street when a National Guardsman stopped me. Said, "I'm sorry, sir, you can't go downtown," and so forth. And I explained to him how important I was. I was a presiding district magistrate, and I had to get down to disaster headquarters. And he looked at me, and frankly, I've seen pictures of myself in those days. I looked to be about 21 years old. He said, "You're what?" And I said, "I'm the presiding district magistrate." And he said, "Sure you are. So I'm sorry, sir, you can't go downtown." So I drove around for about 15 minutes until I found a patrol, police officers in a patrol car, and they escorted me down to chief of police here was somehow able to arrange for my wife and daughters to get on the only plane that was ready to go the next morning. So they left, and the next day, several days were very, very busy for me. I flew by helicopter to Whittier, where people at a sawmill at the end of the bay were killed, but no one else in Whittier was. And then we took the helicopter from Whittier to Seward. Genevieve Schaefermeyer, the magistrate there at the time, the deputy magistrate, was doing everything very well. There was really not much for me to do there. I then flew back to Anchorage. The next morning I got up and flew in a DC-3 to Cordova and a Super Cub from Cordova to Valdez, where everything was gone. I mean, the town was gone. The magistrate and her family were all right, but the office was gone, and it was a matter of many, many months later that documents from the court recording, there were recording office at that time as well. People were bringing in documents to the, I think, trailer that we set up the court in here. But Valdez was gone. Valdez was the only place that I went where the people were severely psychologically affected. I know that I was called to go over to one situation where a gentleman standing on his vacant lot where his home had been was pointing a rifle at people, telling them not to set foot on his property. It's just, and a number of people were killed there when the ship was at harbor, got tossed around. I flew back again from nothing bigger than a Super Cub could have landed there because the ground everywhere was exactly like jello. You walked around on it and it quivered. Then I got back to Anchorage, and the next morning or later that evening flew over to Kodiak. The magistrate, Deputy Magistrate Mabel Fenner, who was in the hospital at the time of the quake because of a heart problem, died while in the hospital, so there was no judicial presence there. The city council had an emergency meeting and appointed one of two lawyers in Kodiak, Roy Madsen, to be the magistrate. Obviously, they had no authority to do that. Roy knew they had no authority to do that, but somebody needed to do something, and he was willing. And I got over there 3 days later, and I signed a document that I had no authority to sign. Also appointing him as the deputy magistrate for there. And when I got back here, Ed Davis signed a similar order non pro tempore the time of the earthquake. So everything Roy had done was given benediction. But that was pretty astounding to me. I had tried a few cases over there, and to get there and find the entire waterfront gone, to find 90 plus feet boats, six, seven blocks from the water up in the schoolyard. The people there, in sharp contrast to some of the people in Valdez, took it all in stride, no big thing. Very few deaths compared to what you would have expected. The local trooper, Trooper Don Church, was a local hero because he, even in the face of oncoming waves, was driving around town with his siren blaring and ordering everybody up the hill and hauling some people who couldn't go up the hill. He was amazing. I was back there to do a trial in August. Porthouse incidentally wasn't damaged at all. It was high on a hill. It was the old district court, U.S. District Court. And I was looking out the window of the courthouse. The state ferry was out there. And it just, I think that was its first trip to Kodiak, if I remember correctly. They pulled up their anchor and brought up a section of dock that had washed out there. Within moments, I got a call telling me that a body had floated to the surface after they left the dock, and I needed to do my coroner duty. This isn't pleasant, but one arm and one leg had been sticking out from under the board, and the crabs had eaten those, and the rest of the body was intact. Not a pleasant day. Although the wife of the gentleman was quite relieved when it was over.
The national media, as I remember, portrayed the earthquake by showing that parts of Fourth Avenue in Anchorage had dropped some 20 feet.
Correct.
And I assume, because it was there when I got here, that the district court survived the earthquake. Is that?
That court building had no damage.
Not
941, contrary to what some people have said, there was no damage to the structure. Library shelves, which were pretty tinny in the first place, fell over and collapsed up in the law library. A lot of stuff fell off the top of cabinets. Some of the cabinets actually tipped over when the drawers opened, I guess, the week. The earthquake was on Friday, and as far as the condition of the building was concerned, we could have started again on Tuesday if we had power. The local bar association had a meeting out quite near where the Bob Atwood mansion is now, there was a golf course and a club out there. We had a meeting out there, I think, about a week after the quake, with all the judges there and all the lawyers there. We're going to try to decide when we could fire up again. There was an earthquake, an aftershock, we'll call it, while we were in session. Somebody looking out the window screamed there was a tsunami coming, and people just bolted out the door. I looked around, and there were six people still seated, all of whom were judges. The lawyers had, there was not a lawyer left. left the premises.
And I take it there was no tsunami?
No tsunami.
No, I don't remember.
There was no tsunami. But the judge, Ed Davis was the judge, presiding judge when I got here, Ralph Moody. Jim Fitzgerald and Hugh Gilbert. That was the Superior Court here. As I understood it, Gilbert had first been a judge in Nome, then somehow transferred down here, later transferred from here to Ketchikan.
Yeah.
Whereupon he retired, although still on the payroll. And they sometimes couldn't find Judge Gilbert for a long, long time, and they'd find him at a resort nearby. But he was not here for very long. He was a jovial, very friendly person. The other judges were here for a long time, and as you know, Judge Fitzgerald, after going on the Supreme Court for a while, I was appointed to the District Court. And I think he's probably at least 5 or 6 years older than I am, and he's, although a senior judge, still trying cases over in the Judge Von der Heit was also made a federal district judge, and he doesn't try cases anymore. He's older than Fitzgerald, but he does a lot of settlement conferences. Both of them spend most of their days in the federal courthouse.
Was it in this era, or was it later that Seaborn, Buckaloo, and Conneaut, Penny, and so
they were all appointed after I was.
Oh, I know that.
I was appointed in 1970, late 70. I served Kenai half time and Anchorage half time until the Supreme Court and the administrative director conned me into going over and establishing the Bethel Court in 1976. So then instead of 2 weeks in Anchorage and 2 weeks in Kenai, I was almost 2 weeks in Bethel until we got that up and running. And then Chris Cook was appointed to Bethel. 1981, when I really didn't have time, I was again approached and seduced into doing the same task in Barrow. So I went to Barrow for about 14 months and set up that court. Judge Jeffries was appointed after I was there, and he is still there. He has been there since 1982.
Fill me in on what happened between when you were a magistrate, then you left the bench, correct?
Correct.
And you practiced law?
I did.
And where and why, you know, what were your major areas of practice, and what was the culture of the bar like at that point?
Well, frankly, when I left the district court, I had always wanted to be a Superior Court judge. And in those days, nobody had ever gone from the district court directly to the Superior Court. The district court was somewhat looked down on. And I was advised that if I ever wanted to be a Superior Court judge, I'd better go out into private practice, establish for the rest of the lawyers in town that I could make a living there, that I could understood the economics of private practice. Is one of the big complaints the lawyers had, that some of the judges had no idea what burdens a practicing attorney bore. And they also, although I'd gotten high marks, I think, from the attorneys for presiding over trials, they had no idea in the world what I could do as a lawyer. So my intention was to go out and practice for probably 5 years or so, and then take a run at the Superior Court. The governor then was Keith Miller. I got very active immediately in Republican politics, not for any, not that I thought it would help me get a Superior Court appointment, but it's just that that's what I was, a conservative Republican. And I got pretty active in it, and I got to know everybody in the Republican hierarchy. Jim Singleton, now a senior district judge, and I were very active in the Republican Party. And about October, I got a call from someone in the governor's office wanting to know if I wanted to be a Superior Court judge. And I said, not yet. I'm making an awful lot more money now than a Superior Court judge makes, and I really need to catch up financially, so I'm really not interested at this time, but thank you for thinking of me. Well, and I had some experiences with other lawyers, and that really annoyed me, and I started thinking differently. So I called Ken Brady, who was then on the Judicial Council, but really was Governor Miller's point man on judicial selection. So I called Ken and I told the governor's office a few weeks ago that I wasn't interested, but I changed my mind. And he suggested that I not do anything embarrassing in the next month or so, and was fairly certain that I would be appointed if I got through the Judicial Council. I really didn't know how I was going to fare in the bar pool, and I had a gentleman who despised me on the Judicial Council. He's a gentleman from Seward, Alaska, who owned the liquor stores in Seward, and I had once stated at a city council meeting in Seward that the major problem for juveniles in Seward was alcohol, and it was my understanding that anybody who could place a coin, could place money, reach the counter to put money on it in the liquor stores could buy booze. Well, this gentleman, whose name I won't, was on the council, the city council at that time, and he became very angry. And then the next time I saw him, it was he was on the to intervene me on the Judicial Council. I thought I'd hit it, but I got through, and I was then advised by the governor's office that although he wasn't going to make the appointment until after the election, I could start cleaning up my practice, which I did. And so I was appointed by the governor, then outgoing Governor Miller. An interesting thing that you may or may not want to keep in this film is that for reasons that I don't think we need to go in for this purpose, Governor Egan and I were not friends. We had not been friends since I was with Furman Juno. And Governor Miller lost the election. Governor Egan came back into office. And just a week or so later, I received a call from the Chief Justice saying that he had just received some word from Juno that when Governor Egan was sworn in, he intended to try to set aside my appointment. And the Chief Justice and two other justices swore me in that day, which made it impossible then for Governor Egan. It was impossible anyway, but it would have taken significant litigation. But I was saved by some espionage there.
From my own experience in Alaska, I mean, I had often testified in front of the legislature that the three most prevalent problems in the state were alcohol, and that a lot of the domestic violence, a lot of the problems in the bush emanated from that fact. Also, that there was only a subsistence economy in the bush, and there were no jobs, so there wasn't a lot to do a lot of times. But did you find that the alcohol to be a prevalent problem throughout your judicial career, or were other things supplanting it?
Well, there was no question at the beginning it was alcohol, And as the presiding district judge, as you know, it was my responsibility to take care of all of the magistrate stations. So I traveled from Cold Bay to Valdez to Glen Allen to a lot of the bush communities. I would go into the villages and meet with them when they had complaints about the magistrates and so forth. And in the 60s, alcohol, I agree with you 100%. Now, in rural areas, it's expanded. It's still mostly alcohol. And a lot of villages have gone dry, but bootlegging, we simply haven't approached. We haven't even tried to find a way to stop that. Troopers are in very short supply in rural Alaska. But there's a lot of marijuana, there's a lot of cocaine. I don't know how they can afford it, but it's there. I've been hearing cases out in Methalec from about 3 years ago. And substance abuse now, I'll give it a broader category, and that is the problem. The very mild-mannered, friendly gentleman who wouldn't hurt a fly while sober does terrible things to his wife and children.
And you were in charge of basically magistrates and training, and expand on that for me. Tell me about that magistrate system, how it evolved over time, because you saw it early on and you've really seen it throughout the span of your career.
The there was a very well drafted book called The Magistrate's Handbook that was in use in the 1960s. I don't know who authored the book. It was specific to Alaska and had to have occurred in 1960, 61 or 62, but it was extremely well done. In the third district, I think a very, very good job had been done appointing the people out there. And about the only training they got was when the presiding district judge came out there and sat down with them. And they usually had a bunch of questions to ask, and the magistrate's handbooks were well worn. That is about all there was until 1968 when I left the district court.
And these people, they were appointed because they were respected in their communities,
mm-hmm.
And then they could build consensus.
They were. When there would be a turnover, I would go out to the community and I would meet with any organization that was there, and I would talk to the troopers, and if there was any kind of a medical facility, I'd go talk to everybody I could, and then I would come back and make the recommendation to the presiding judge, who during my time was first Judge Davis and then Judge Wood. And both of those judges took the appointment of the Bush judges very, very seriously. And I don't recall where we've had some problems in the fourth district where the magistrates embarrassed us. But I don't ever recall such an event in the third district.
And in the third district, was it similar to the other districts? I remember when I came that most of the magistrates were still working off their kitchen tables. They didn't have facilities. They didn't have equipment. The third district was more urbanized than the rest of the state, so it might not have been the same way in the third district. What were the facilities like?
In Cordova and in Seward, the magistrates had courtrooms. In fact, the magistrate in Cordova had the most beautiful courtroom you could imagine. I hope it's still there. It was it had been a U.S. district courtroom in the early days. It was all oak. The bench was way up in the air. I haven't been in a courtroom that has impressed me more than the Cordova courtroom. But the rest of them, yes. Working off the tables, or sometimes they got a desk. They worked off the desk.
Well, I too remember the Cordova courtroom, and I was out fishing that way with Jim Fitzgerald and some other folks, and we unexpectedly came into Cordova and the hotels were full, so I had to find the magistrate, and we slept in that courtroom. Jim slept behind the bench where a judge should, and I slept out by the jury box. So,
do you remember who the magistrate was at that time?
I don't. It was a woman, though.
Oh, it's after Rod McDonald. Then.
It was. Okay. Your memory of names is much surpasses mine. I forget my name half the time.
Well, I can't remember my children's name. I had a lot of them.
Right, so you came on the bench as a Superior Court judge now, and most of your time was, as you said, spent in Kenai and up in Anchorage and out in Bethel. Talk to me about those three communities and the differences you saw.
When I was appointed in Kenai, it was ridiculous because there were only three lawyers in Kenai and one in Homer. And there was one semi-retired lawyer who I never ever saw, ever, in Seward. So there really wasn't much to do there as a judge at first, but very quickly there came a public defender and a district attorney, and for a while a legal services attorney. When I started, as I told you, there were three in Anchorage, one in Homer, one in Seward, and last I knew there were 52 lawyers on the Kenai Peninsula. They've gone from one half-time Superior Court judge, which myself. Now they have three Superior Court judges, I think one, possibly two district court judges, and a couple of hearing officers and magistrates and masters. The population explosion there has gone from 12,000 when I started to well over 50,000 people on the peninsula now.
And what drove that population increase, do you think?
Beats me. Well, the oil industry did it. It's a bedroom. Kenai still got in our bedroom communities for the oil, the North Slope. Fishing for a number of years was very, very big there. The fishing industry is nothing on the northern Kenai Peninsula. It's still an industry in Homer, but there aren't any fishermen making money on the Kenai River anymore. The sportsmen have taken it over, and I guess that's a natural progression of things. A lot of the people that I came to know there were in education. Because I was in the Civil Air Patrol, I got to know quite a variety of other people. And it was kind of fun going to Civil Air Patrol because there I would run into I would see on a routine basis the foreman of the jury that had just either convicted or acquitted somebody. Much to my surprise, and then he would come over and insist on telling me why they convicted this person or acquitted that person. And he said, "You didn't agree with us, did you?" And I said, "How can you tell that?" And he said, "Well, I talked to your clerk, and she said, when you leave the bench as quickly as you did, it's because you're annoyed." But I tried very hard not to let the juries know that they had done something I disagreed with. Didn't happen often. I had a couple of major cases there where I feel the jury was terribly wrong. That happened a lot in Anchorage, which is why and probably the only reason I've always opposed the death penalty so vigorously. We just made mistakes. I made them, the jurors made them,